Morning.
Morning.
Hi. So this morning I'm going to talk about the Sandokai. And in your program you'll see the quotations I'm going to talk about today. It's my third talk on the Sandokai, which is translated as the harmony of separation and oneness. And the lines I'm going to talk about are in your program, and I'm also going to read them. So I'm going to start where I left off in my last talk with the lines, all the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, yet each keeps its place. So just a little review for some of you who weren't here for my first two talks. Sound separateness is the world of discrimination, differentiation, objects, concepts, distinctions. Everyday world. Dull, oneness, the world of darkness, where you can't distinguish one thing from another, where there aren't any objects or even any experiences, because in oneness there's only oneness, and there's not even any sense this is one. And everything is the same. So as I was saying last week or in my first talk, I don't remember which, some people have to work more in the dull. They need to give to others. They need to open up. They need to not be caught in a sense of separateness because they're too encapsulated by it. And they really need to work in the dull. Some people really need to work in the sun. They are people who just always giving everything away and don't have any sense of self because they're just giving. So those people need to work in the sun. Some people need to do both. Most of us need to do both at different times in our lives, right? And as I said last time, a lot of relationships have ended because both people are trying to be the same. Both people are trying to be in the oneness. And that doesn't work. Think of your relationships and how often trying to be like the other person leads to dismal failure. Pretty often, huh? So early Buddhist psychology, we can say, is all about the san, all about separateness. In early Buddhist psychology, everything is separate, and all there are is sense experiences. They're sense experiences. The five sense experiences, and then a sixth sense that they call thought. And it's the coming together of the nose and the honey and the consciousness between the nose and the honey that creates a sense of sweetness, but they're all separate. And you can say the same for sound, you can say the same for touch, you can say the same thing for all of the six senses, including thought. There needs to be both the organ and the object and consciousness. And then out of that we fabricate a world. My world, Ben's world, Judy's world. But that world is a fabrication, according to early Buddhist psychology. The idea of oneness is absent completely. All we need to do is realize that this self is a fabrication that comes out of not being discriminating enough, not slowing down and seeing and feeling each sense, each thought. And we do that, then there's a liberation. And when we do that, there's often in meditation, there can be a shimmering kind of kaleidoscopic feeling. Everything just sort of impressionist drawing after another, impressionist painting after another, with no sense of impressionism, just ooh, 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 because it's all here, and we're not glomming onto it with a story time, storyline. We're not. So that's early Buddhist psychology, and that's based on everything being different, and the fictional self being a product of that. But then, the other side, Do, in the Heart Sutra, no eyes. You know, I have to read it. I've been chanting every morning for like 40 years, but when I'm doing a talk, I can't remember it. So here it is. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness. You get it? So what they're doing is they're taking all of the discrete moments of early Buddhist psychology, which they're saying they don't exist. They're co-created. It really all is one entity. Without an object, there is no sight. Without a sound, there is no hearing. So they're not two different things. They're just it's just another system for talking about reality. Everything is co-created. So that's there's nothing separate really there. So Sekito, the guy who wrote this in the 8th century, is saying, both of these are going on always at the same time. But we're generally only aware of the interaction. We're generally not aware of the fact that they're not two. We're generally forgetting in either that the entire universe is appearing right now, and that there are these two sides to every moment. There's the interactional. There's the Ted's here and I'm here. Ted's there and I'm here. The interactional. And there's the nothing. No one thing. Just oneness of all of us. Before we say Ted and Tim, always. So we, on the other hand, Ted's there and Tim's here. So we think oneness is better. And the immediate we think oneness is better, we turn it into something concrete that we want. But oneness is not better. It's just something else, which isn't even one. So here's a quote from my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, about this line. A bird comes from the south in spring and goes back in the fall, crossing various mountains, rivers, and oceans. In this way, things are interrelated endlessly everywhere, yet each keeps its place. This means that even though the bird stays in the same place, in some lake, for instance, his home is not only the lake, but also the whole world. This is how a bird lives. Okay, now I want to talk about the next line. I want to spend the next half hour or so talking about the next line. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Well, I haven't talked about this in a few years, but what it reminds me of is John Cage. I remember talking about it with Monica years ago, and I think with Ben. John Cage. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. So what's music and what's noise? What's music and what's noise? We know what's music and what's noise, right? That chainsaw that ruined my hearing, every time I hear it, that's noise. I mean, that ain't music, right? And yet that's within the divided, in the separateness. But in the oneness, what's music and what's noise? It's just our preconceptions. It's just our prejudgment. So I first was exposed to this when I was reading a book by John Cage. Raise your hand if you know who John Cage is. Oh, about a third of you. Okay. A third of the older people in the room. Sorry. It's true. So John Cage was a musician who radically changed his music after listening to D.T. Suzuki speak about Zen. John Cage was very interested in Zen, and D.T. Suzuki was speaking about Zen at Columbia University. And John Cage went to listen to D.T. Suzuki speak, and D.T. Suzuki spoke in a very soft voice. And apparently Columbia University, I don't know this, was underneath an area where airplanes were always going over, right? So airplanes would go over in the middle of D.T. Suzuki's talk, and he didn't raise his voice at all. And at first, John Cage was pretty pissed. But after a while, he began to pay attention to the noise of the airplanes. According to his own statements, he changed his whole way of doing music after that, which was to show that all noise is potentially music, and to do that in his artistry and his work and his writing and his life. So he was showing the dough. He was showing the oneness. And so when I was sitting in San Francisco Zen Center, it was on a very busy street called Bush Street in San Francisco, which is a one-way street, sitting at 5:30 p.m. We sat 5 a.m., 5:30 a.m., and 5:30 p.m., and the cars would rush by at 5:30 p.m. So I just tried to use my John Cage technique. It worked pretty well. I just tuned it in. Just, oh, this is part of it. Just like, I'll make this the object of my meditation. It worked great, actually. And then John Cage came to town one day. Although I don't remember actually seeing him. I remember going to the concert. I don't remember seeing him. Maybe it was just his piece and he wasn't there. But anyway, we all paid a whole bunch of money to go see him. A whole bunch of money being something like $6. You know. This is a long time ago, right? So we went to see him. I paid my $6. We went to see him. We went and sat down in the audience room. Somebody came out on the stage, and they had one of those stands where you turn the pages of the music. And you know what they did. They stood and turned the pages, one page after another, after another, after another, after another, and that was the whole concert. And again, I was pissed. It wasn't. I was pissed. $6. $6 to hear that. So that was my San experience. That was my experience of separateness. I'm never going to do that again, and I never have. Whenever John Cage came to town, I said, I'm not doing that. I could give it free at Zen Center, or just free by sitting out on Bush Street. We need to pay attention to our money. We need to pay attention to the. If we don't pay attention to our money, who are we? We need to pay attention to it. The difference, the separation. So both difference and oneness. On each moment in our lives. Dark is a good image for oneness. And in my first talk, I talked about dark, because dark is used by Sekito a lot in this prose poem. Because in the dark, you don't know. You don't know. And in this phrase, he says, refined and common speech come together in the dark. But he uses the metaphor over and over again. In the dark, you don't know if it's a nice object or not nice object. In the light, you can see everything, right? Clear, murky, discreet, incorrect, beautiful things, broken things, ugly things. In the light. Light and dark. Which is better? What's not better? Sandokai, the shaking hands. Both present on each moment. Both present on each moment. And of course, we don't like dark usually because we're afraid of it. That's the fear body that I was talking about last week. Fear body that we develop. Early man, early woman develop the fear body to protect themselves from a hostile world out there. So we don't like the dark because it's scary. But in a way, meditation is learning to become an expert on our fear, as I said last time, about our fear. And then it loses its power. But this is not by thinking about it, not by strategy, just by sitting, just by doing meditation. And last time I talked about the fear body as having two major components, our sensations, all the sensations that we have in our body, and then our thoughts. And usually our fear body thoughts are about no. They tell us what we can't, what we shouldn't, what we aren't capable of. They convince us we'll be judged, we'll be rejected, and abandoned if we express our true heart's desire. So it's hard for us to speak with our true voice because of that fear body. There's hard to shake hands between separation and oneness because of the domination of that fear body, because of its density. And as I said last time, our fears pretend that they know what the future will bring. They pretend that, right? But they don't know. Who knows? Do you know? I don't know. But our fuel, our mind that's fueled by fear, persuades us, and it paralyzes us. I'll protect myself. I'll protect myself. So is it possible that we can stop believing these invented thoughts, these limited thoughts, with bad outcomes? Yes, it's possible. And be released from a gloomy future. Right now at Zen Center, we're starting to go through a visioning process to envision the next 5 years. And I've been through these many times, and the first thing I know the consultant is going to say, we'll see if the consultant says this, but I think the first thing he's going to say is, in the visioning process, you're not allowed to use your... they won't say it this way. They won't talk about the fear body. They'll say, you just vision. No critical. No criticism. No what-ifs. No maybe-nots. You just do it. You just do it. Because that's what visioning is. That's what visioning is. And with no fear driving us, no longer driving us, what do we really want? What do we really care about? What do we want Zen Center to be about? So we need to harness the reality of our fear, because it's here, by knowing it fully, and that's where we can find our true voice, by just getting to know the context of the fear so that it no longer daunting. The context and the content of our fear so that it doesn't dominate. So it doesn't squelch our visioning. So Sekito says, refined and common speech come together in the dark, intimate with darkness. We can become intimate with darkness. We become intimate with darkness and we let go of the fear body. We then manifest the so-called Buddha body, Kaya. Buddha Kaya, which has three components. The Dharma Kaya, which is timelessness or dull, oneness, oneness. Nirmanakaya, which is time, separation, dividedness, distinction, and sambhogakaya. Great joy that comes up when we realize that everything is one and yet not one at the same time. And we appreciate our separateness and also realize our undividedness. So when I was giving my first Sandokai talk, I talked about being with my grandmother when I was a young boy. And my grandmother, I lived in a very dark house. No, we had electricity, so but when we went upstairs to her bedroom, it was totally dark and there were no street lights. And it was a little scary for me because my mama always gave me my nightlight in every room, in every corner of my room. I don't know what the deal was with my grandma. But my grandma let me sleep with her, and my mother didn't, in her great big bed. It was huge, at least as big as this room. my 4-year-old mind, right? Huge. And she let me sleep right next to her, and she was very warm, very warm. And when I started to be a little scared, I said, "Grandma, it's too dark." She said, "Don't worry, dear." And she just put her hand on my shoulder, my head. So I developed, and when I went back home, I wasn't quite so scared about darkness. I still wanted a nightlight, but I didn't freak out when it burned out. Darkness. What is darkness? It's the fear of oneness, in a way. It's the fear of obliteration of 4-year-old Tim or 69-year-old Tim. Because this is how we keep our act together, how we keep our lives together, through 4-year-old Tim or 69-year-old Tim. But Zen practice is about going into darkness. You don't not conjuring darkness. Just sit facing a wall day after day and see what happens. See what happens. So that helped me. My experience with my grandma helped me when I was an adult. And I was sitting, retreat after retreat, facing that wall, not being able to get anywhere. Making some progress and then making some regress. More progress, more regress. And then just nothing. Darkness. So being comfortable with darkness is a way in which we can open up to dull. Not ignoring sun, not ignoring our individual needs for comfort, for separate identity, for authenticity, for food, nurturance, love. Not ignoring that stuff. Both. So in brain science, and I got to be careful about talking about this because I really don't know much about it. I had to study a little brain science to get licensed as a psychologist. I passed the licensing test. And I have to take CEUs to kind of keep it going. So I hope there aren't any brain scientists here. But if you are, you can just critique me. Okay. So we've got the amygdala. How many of you know what the amygdala is? Raise your hand. Oh, we've got some people who've been reading about brain science. Whoa. That's okay. The amygdala. A yellow, almond-shaped part of the brain that is in the lower part of the brain. Developed much earlier than the cerebral cortex, right? Much earlier than the cerebral cortex. The old brain developed hundreds of years ago. Thousands of years ago. Gazillions of years ago. Right? Who knows? And it stores what? Implicit, unconscious, emotional memories that help us survive. We need an amygdala. And it also does what? It activates the fight or flight response. That's the world of differentiation. That's the world of individuality. We need to protect ourselves. We need to pay attention. That's the amygdala. But the deal is, what? Those of you who studied it, we overuse it. We overuse the amygdala. Partly, Zen practice is about learning to actually decrease the density in the amygdala. I will point to one study that I read about of meditators, long-term meditators, being measured on their brain activity, and the results that their long-term meditators have a much more plasticity within their amygdala. They are not just running the same fight or flight pathways from their 2-year-old mind. They have developed much more plasticity. So if nothing else, you might sit for that reason. You might sit for that reason. Who knows? So when our partner or our lover or our best friend or our student or whatever, a colleague at work, becomes our enemy, we're in the grip of what's referred to by modern psychologists as an amygdala hijack. An amygdala hijack. Our emotional memory hijacks our relationship. It hijacks our relationship. So there's no dough, it's just song. There's no sense of intimacy. It's just, I gotta watch this guy. I gotta watch him. And then there's a third type of activity that I talked about last time that involves the amygdala, but I'm not exactly sure how. And I tried reading about it, but I couldn't figure it out. And that's we fight away, or we what? As I said last time, we numb out, we anesthetize. We anesthetize. So a friend of mine was in a pretty bad auto accident, but she wasn't physically really too hurt, and the two cars hit, and she was able to pull herself out of the car. Her windshield was shattered, and her door was, smashed in two, but she had a good seatbelt on, so she's okay. She got out, she climbed out the window, and then she very calmly went and saw how the other people in the other car were doing, flagged another car down, called the police, made the police report, totally calm. Then a month later, she just ran over a curve, just a little curve, ran over a little curve, and burst into tears, overflowing. So her, she had protected herself by anesthetizing, by numbing out during the actual experience, and then later, it fired up when she was safe. So anyway, those are three ways in which the feared body tends to dominate. And the third way, and they're all healthy. They're all healthy. The amygdala is important. It's just that we overdo it. We do it. We don't need more than about 15% of that. There aren't that many tigers and lions around. I know you guys look scary, but there aren't that many. You don't look too scary. So we can question when we see our pattern, can't we? Is this an old pattern? Is our reaction based on a false belief or on the present, on what's going on right now? Is our reaction coming from a past experience? What are the resources and options I have right now? And can we use a reminding word or phrase to just let go of this amygdala activity and just come back to it? And, your meditators. What is it you say to yourself? What do you say? Do you say peace? Do you say just this? Do you say okay? I recommend that meditators have some word or phrases they use to help them when they start to get stressed out in their meditational lives. Both. It could be your sacred mantra. Just this is fine. Doesn't matter, right? Oh, shall I stop or shall I keep going? Huh? Shall I stop or shall I keep going? Okay. And then how can you change your response? And what have you learned from the situation? That's all good stuff. That's stuff in the song. That's stuff in the individual. Again, sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. We make judgments, and it's important that we make judgments. It's important that we make judgments that are well thought through. And at the same time, we know that there are no judgments that are fundamentally holy. Nothing holds. So in the world of Sando, which is right now, oneness and difference, each perception comes, and there can just be a little letting go of that perception without trying to let go of it. A little letting go. And when your Zen practice gets more mature, that letting go kind of just starts to happen on its own. Kind of, but don't make anything out of it or look for it. So sometimes we need to argue. It's good to argue. It's important to argue. It's part of being authentically who we are in the world of distinctions which we live. Amygdala charge arguments aren't so cool. But arguments in which we really, really engage our cognitive faculties, I mean, we have cognitive faculties for a reason. And sharp cognitive faculties can help us a lot. So arguing and debating is sometimes very important. Very important. And even defending our argument. Can we defend our argument? Can Tim defend his argument without becoming defensive? That's the deal. Defending the argument without becoming defensive, without revving up the amygdala, right? That little almond-shaped yellow thing that's supposedly in there someplace. It's all revved up. So we'll be, as I said a few minutes ago, working on developing a vision for Zen Center's future. We'll be working with a consultant and then develop a 5-year plan out of that vision. And I'm sure that there will be competing visions. So, okay, cool. Not something to get amygdala out about. Right? Competing visions. But we can let them go. But not, I should let it go. As soon as you said, I should let it go, what is that? That's the fear body. I should let it go. A little tricky. So now I want to suggest some patterns or habits of thinking that sustain the fear body that keep the amygdala in overdrive. And you guys have read about these, some of them or all of them, I'm sure. Just my own little list, actually it's my own long list. All or nothing thinking. All or nothing thinking. Everything's either entirely good or entirely bad. If you don't do something perfectly, you've failed. I'm the head teacher here. If the Sangha doesn't accept my vision, then something or other. What? They're bad or I'm... What? They're bad, I guess. You guys are bad. Bad. Dumb. Unenlightened. Oh, yeah, you're unenlightened. That's what you are. You're unenlightened. You should all get enlightened. Come sit with me for 33 minutes or 33 years. And you're sure to get enlightened. Always never thinking. Always never thinking. You see a single negative event as part of a pattern. You always forget to pay the bills. You always, she says to him. I won't say who says to who. He says to her. But as soon as you do that, you trap. You trap the person. You trap yourself. This is not an always or never world. This is not an always or never world. And I'm trapped in, oh, God, I just can't do this. I'm no good. But if she says, well, gee, I did notice that you forgot to pay the last 4 bills. And I think, oh, yeah, there were only 4. Well, that's different, right? That's not, that doesn't trap me. That doesn't get my amygdala fired up. Pretty different, don't you think? Pretty different. Mind reading. You think you know what people think about you or something you've done, and it's bad. It's bad. We interpret. We're always interpreting people's body language, people's phrases, and then we create our story. Mind reading. Fortune telling. You don't think you believe in fortune telling? I think most people do. There are certain things that are just going to turn out badly, you guys. Well, look at climate change. Look at it. Look at what we've done. Look, it's inevitable. It's just going to turn out badly. Isn't it very clear? But that's fortune telling. We don't know. There are so many variables involved. We don't know. We don't know. And we can go into the unknown and develop a vision and possibly change things. Maybe not. But we don't need a fortune tell about the future, do we? Magnification and minimization. You exaggerate the significance of minor problems while trivializing your accomplishments. We all do this. Now, how we got acculturated to do this, I don't know. I know our mamas and daddies tried to raise us well, but we do this. We do this. Should statements, which I talk about all the time, so I won't talk about them anymore today. Personalizing, right? Personalizing. Oh, it's my fault. Oh. I'm the one. Focusing on the negative in each experience. And then just simple comparative thinking. He's sitting so still. She's doing such a good job of calming herself down when I can't even begin to calm down at all, et cetera, et cetera. So Zazen then. Meditation, Zen meditation. It's partly witnessing. Of course, we don't use that term. They use that term more in Vipassana. But it is a witnessing because you're sitting down and you're looking. You're paying attention to what's going on without thinking about it. So you are witnessing. And you're witnessing your patterns. These patterns that I talk about, you're witnessing in your meditation. And whether you don't need to categorize them. Better not to categorize them, because then but you're witnessing. You're seeing how you get caught in different ways. And then as your bare awareness and your sitting carries over into your daily life, you're doing that same thing. You're witnessing. You're noticing when you're doing all or nothing thinking. You're noticing when you're focusing on the negative. And witnessing the patterns disrupts them. Period. Not comma, witnessing them and criticizing them and trying to change them. Period, 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 period. Only period, you guys. Only period. Nothing more. No more punctuation, okay? Cut it out. Cut it out. Just the witnessing disrupts them. It just disrupts them. And also witnessing the gaps in your patterns disrupts them. There are gaps, believe it or not. There are gaps in your moments. There are gaps in your experience. And witnessing disrupts the patterns. So I thought we would do a little exercise for a moment. And I like all of you who don't fear darkness too much to close your eyes. And take two or three deep breaths and just let go of any tension or stress that you don't need. And if you need to move your body to get in a more comfortable posture, just do that. And now I'd like you to, with your eyes closed, put the word enjoy, move the word enjoy into the upper left-hand corner of your visual field. Enjoy. Just put it there. Just gently rest it there. Enjoy. And then when you've done that, I'd like you to take the word being and rest the word being. Place the word being comfortably in the right, upper right-hand side of your visual field. Enjoy on the left and being on the right. And now, just take a couple of deep breaths in the space between the enjoy and the being. Just take a couple of breaths in the space in between that, those two words. Good. And now when you're ready, just let enjoy fall away, go where it wants to, and move being over to the left-hand side, upper left-hand side, where enjoy was. And now, take present and put present up in the right-hand side of your visual field. So you've got being in the left-hand side and present in the right-hand side. And then when you're ready, notice the space between those and take two or three nice breaths in between the being and the present. Okay, and then when you're ready, just bring yourself back to the room and open your eyes. Okay, so that's just an example of what actually will begin to happen spontaneously if you continue this practice. It will happen. And even if the gap is only this small, it's huge. It's timeless. Even only lasts this long. It's huge. It's infinite. It's the Dharmakaya Buddha. The timeless Buddha is that tiny gap. So I want to finish my talk with a quote from Suzuki Roshi about this line. For those of you who heard my first talk, Suzuki Roshi has a book on the Sandokai called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, which I actually gave, actually I did a class on about 13 or 14 years ago. Okay, so here's Suzuki Roshi's final comment to us this morning about Sandokai, about individuality and oneness. Okay? Because Buddhas know both sides of reality, they have this composure. They are not disturbed by something bad or ecstatic about something good. They have a true joy that will always be with them. We call this Sambhogakaya. Sambhogakaya. The basic tone of life remains the same, and in it there are some happy melodies and some sad melodies. This is the feeling an enlightened person may have. It means that when it is hot or when you are sad, you should be completely involved in being hot or being sad without caring for happiness. When you are happy, you should just enjoy happiness. We can do this because we are ready for anything. We're ready for anything. Even though circumstances change suddenly, we don't mind. Today we may be very happy, and the next day we don't know what will happen to us. When we are ready for what will happen tomorrow, then we can enjoy today completely. You do this not by studying in a lecture, but through your practice. So those are my teacher's final words, although they're not final, because nothing is ever final. Questions, comments?
Actually, I have a quote from Rod Sterling.
Okay.
And it goes, there's nothing in the dark to fear that isn't there in the light. Kind of reflects on that here, but I won't talk about
it. Thank you, Rod Sterling. Uh-huh. Anybody else? Other questions? Oh, Larry.
Yeah, just kind of a comment. I don't know if it relates to what you're saying. I live in Tucson for years. You know, And I lead night hikes up in Sabino Canyon down there. Part of Sabino Canyon, a meditative place. Before the full moon last month. Anyway, so we go out there at night. And one of the things to tell people is try not to use flashlights, so, okay? Because what you get when you have a flashlight out there at night, and a lot of people start out this way from living in the city, being used to the ambient light. I tell people, try to avoid using flashlights, and so it's a lot nicer, kind of see things more clearly in the nighttime. It's much nicer. If you use a flashlight, you get this little circle of light, which then, that's all you can see. I think it's kind of analogous to kind of conscious mind. We're always serving this conscious mind. Kind of turn it off, you can see all this, see it in nighttime. And then I tell them that if you're afraid of
practical instruction. Anybody else? Yeah.
Well, just thank you for your talk. It reminded me of that. There's a great film of Suzuki Roshi at Tassajara talking about the Sandokai and someone's sound and noise.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Talks about the blue jay.
Around
Tassajara. So when you're in the Zendo, you're always hearing them. I call them the highway patrol.
Yeah.
They're all hassling all the other birds.
Yeah.
They're very noisy.
Uh-huh.
And he says that is noise. He says, but the sound of the bird, as in sound, he said, is inside you. That you are the sound. And that's the difference. So if you differentiate between them, you're making that the sound and the do.
Good.
Thank you.
Good. So is that a video?
And it comes up.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Thank you.